Coming up on 27 minutes after the hour on this Tuesday morning, Dr. Don Clark joins us. Don, a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments. And if you've listened to the station for long, you know he joins us regularly, like clockwork, just about every Tuesday morning. And we've learned so much from him over the years, most recently about COVID and vaccines and the mRNA, the nature of that kind of a vaccine and what's going on with COVID. But generally, if you look at the long history of our discussions, we've talked about Genesis and creationism and taken kind of the scientific view of that. And that's the topic today. Yesterday's Breakpoint program, if you were listening, had to do with some DNA logic here that applies not favorably to the world of evolution. In fact, I'm thinking that maybe the discovery of DNA and how it works may be the chink in their armor. And to start with, Don, I'm wondering if you could maybe distinguish for us between evolution, intelligent design, and creationism. What's the difference? It's been said by some, as it mentions in the article, that intelligent design is religion pretending to be science. What say you?
Okay, well, yeah, interesting question to start off with, but we'll, we'll tackle it. Well, evolution, of course, the way Darwin described it, was the slow evolving process, materialistic process. There are no outside forces, slow gradual changes in organisms to go from one organism to the next. So, for example, to go from the primordial soup into a one-celled animals, creatures, to fish and fish with amphibians, and then from amphibians eventually to mammals and monkeys, and then eventually up to man. And that was supposed to be, according to Darwin, a very slow process, a tedious process, but slow. Got his ideas from Charles Carlyle, who was a geologist, who said, wow, it looks like the Earth was formed over a long period of time. And so marrying those two ideas, he says, well, there's probably enough time for evolution to have occurred and to bring us to the state that we're in today. So that's the original evolution. We'll talk about other variants on evolution as we go on in this program. Now, intelligent design says, well, if you look at especially biology, but if you look at things around us, you'll see that it looks like everything was designed, that it wasn't just happenstance, it wasn't just a coincidence, that thing just came together. It was actually designed. So there is a designer somewhere. We don't know what the designer or who the designer is, but it certainly looks like, all of the complexity in life, it looks like it's been designed. So they don't go as far as saying, okay, well, we'll call this designer God, or that they are identifying which God, for example. Of course, we have here on Earth many gods. They're just saying, there was an intelligent designer. Now, a Christian would look at that and say, well, the intelligent designer obviously is the God of creation. It's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as described in the Bible. And so a creationist would take the point of view that, yes, everything is complex, everything is designed, and yes, we got here as described in Genesis. Everything was created within the first 6 days of creation, and we know who that creator is. So that's the difference between the three groups here. And you're in one, everybody's in one camp or the other. Some people have taken the position, well, I don't want to think about that, so I'm not going to really take a stance as to where what I believe. But in actuality, you either believe in a materialistic explanation of how you were here, or you believe in some type of intelligent design or a creator, and it's the creator that we actually must ultimately be accounted to, accounted for, and so you know, our actions should reflect that we have to answer for the things that we do here on Earth. Now, you know, the evolutionists, of course, would say, well, you know, since there is no creator, since there is no one that I'm accountable for, we are just, we have to kind of make up our own rules as we go along. And that is the most destructive thing about the evolutionary theory, as it's so called, and the result that it has on mankind.
Now, doesn't it depend, though, and when was DNA discovered? Because we've been researching it for at least, what, three decades, 1990s maybe? I'm thinking evolutionary eyes must have lit up when they saw that, because now here's a mechanism for creating change, because if one organism morphs or evolves into something else, it must be because DNA has changed. So I'm thinking that they grasped onto this whole DNA topic and said, "Ha, this proves evolution." Does it?
No, it doesn't prove evolution, and you know, of course, it's either a bottom down or a top down approach. You know, creationists look at the complexity of DNA. For example, man, his DNA is, of course, is broken down into the various genes and broken down into the chromosomes that we have, 23 chromosomes. But we have, you know, 3 billion base pairs, DNA base pairs that make up our DNA. That's 3 billion, and so that 3 billion have to be in the exact order in which they're in, and there is some variation, obviously, because we look, you know, not two people look exactly the same, and so, you know, you've got some variation within that 3 billion, but nothing like you would see if, you know, we evolved from other things. And so, you know, some of the evolutionists, the evolutionary biologists, for example, would look at the DNA and say, oh, look, there's a similar sequence in the pig as there is in humans. So therefore, we look pretty much like a pig. And I would look at a pig and look at a human and say, we don't look anything alike. But at least their DNA, you know, there are some similar parts, and maybe, you know, a large portion of the DNA might look similar. But because it looks similar, because it may even have similar sequences, doesn't mean that one evolved from the other. So DNA, of course, how DNA was put together was discovered by Watson and Crick in England in the UK, and they beat out the vitamin C guy.
Pauling? Linus Pauling, maybe?
Linus Pauling. Mm-hmm. Linus Pauling. Yeah. They beat out Linus Pauling in determining the structure from X-ray diffraction patterns, and you know, won the Nobel Prize for it.
When was that, 1990s or earlier?
Oh, very, very much earlier than that. I'm sure that if we get
1953.
53.
Yeah, I thought it was in the 40s or the 50s. It was, pretty 53. Early on. When, you know, those type of techniques, especially X-ray diffraction, and this was X-ray diffraction on a, you know, obviously a very large molecule. So they had to have crystalline DNA in order to determine its structure. But they figured it out, and they got the, you know, they got, you know, like I said, the Nobel Prize for it. And it was a great discovery because not only did they figure out the structure, but they figured out the coding as well. And so they figured out that, hey, 3 base pairs make up 1 amino acid. And so there were, with the number of base pairs, we've got 4 base pairs to choose from. And that gave you 64 possibilities of combining the base pairs. And so we don't have 64 amino acids. You know, we have 20 and 21 amino acids. And so these four base pairs, some of the combination of the base pairs code for, multiple codes for one amino acid, but you also got some base pairs that don't code for anything except for start and stop and other coding type of control type of mechanisms. So God knew what he was doing in the beginning, and of course he coded all of that in. And discovering all that, you would think that Watson and Crick would be, especially, would be religious and would say, wow, you know, God really did make a very complex system here. But they chose not to, and they chose, aha, this is a, we can now explain evolution from the point of DNA. And so all you have to do is just mutate the DNA, and then you'll change an organism.
And those mutations happen with each generation, correct?
They can happen within a generation. I mean, it's the... we've talked about this several years ago, maybe, I don't remember, but that the mutations occur not rapidly, but at a given rate for a given organism and, the given environmental, pressures, for example. So mutations, we know in general the rate for a given organism as to what the rate of mutation is. And
but the point here being that evolution would say that external conditions in the environment prompt changes in DNA. And the creationist would say, no, the ability to change was built in. It's the DNA responding. You know, it's which direction the impetus comes from. Wouldn't a creationist say that God built the ability to adapt into DNA to begin with?
No.
No.
Well, yes and no. Okay, so we have mutations. Okay, mm-hmm. So now the question becomes, once you have a mutation, is it a beneficial mutation? Or is it a detrimental mutation? Or is it a neutral mutation? In other words, changing an adenosine to a guanine, is that going to change anything in its transcription into a messenger RNA, which ultimately goes into translation, translation and then transcription, ultimately expressing itself as a protein somewhere along the line. Now, if you look at the mutations, and we've tried to mutate things by irradiating, for example, fruit flies, and we've irradiated to help accelerate the DNA mutation. Out of doing this for numbers of years, maybe 10 years or so, they've discovered that, there is no positive mutation that happens when we do this. We have many, many detrimental mutations. We might have a fruit fly that only has one pair of wings, for example, and not the full set of wings, so it can't fly, or it's got it's got two heads, or it's got, it's got different things, but there aren't any beneficial mutations coming out of this experiment. So it's not just a matter of saying, it just takes a couple of mutations here and there to change from one organism to the next. It takes thousands and thousands of mutations in the right order and in the right sequence to make a change. So how do you do that? And this paper that is described in the Breakpoint article, for example, says, let's take an imaginary type of experiment. Okay, we have blue marbles and we have red marbles, and they're all mixed up, and we want to pick out all the blue marbles, but we can only pick them out randomly. We can't pick them out, if you could see them you could pick them out, but if the marbles are hidden and you're reaching in and just picking out a marble, It might take you, for example, 2 seconds to pick out the first blue marble. Okay, how long is it going to take you to pick out the next blue marble? And it has to be a blue marble. Well, you pick up, you have a 50-50 chance of picking up a red or a blue marble. So the time required then is going to double. So it takes you 4 seconds to pick out two blue marbles, you know, one blue and then another blue one. And it takes you 8 seconds to pick out three blue marbles, and so it goes. So the difficulty in creating a chain is multiplied exponentially in time. And hence this whole paper, mathematical paper that the Discovery Institute put together and explained that there isn't enough time to describe the changes that are that have to occur between one species and another species, much less between one kind and another kind. And so we just don't, you know, we just don't have enough time. And the other problem that we run into is, you know, Darwinian evolution said that you needed slow, gradual change, and that the change had to be positive, obviously, in order to affect a change in an organism. Well, you know, we look at the
positive meaning adaptation to an existing condition, that is toward improvement of a species.
Yeah, towards improvement of the species, and this whole process of natural selection, that is, we are going to select out naturally the organisms that can survive better equipped to survive whatever conditions they might be in. And so that's called natural selection, and natural selection was going to be the driving force for these evolutionary changes, you know, that we see or that was purported to be seen. And it was this natural selection that ultimately led up to the evolution of man. Well, all is well and good until you look at the fossil record, and then you discover that, wow, there was this thing called the, and there's many of these examples, right? So there's this thing called the Cambrian explosion, where you got, you know, rock layers or sedimentary layers below the Cambrian level, and there's hardly any organisms in it. And then you got the Cambrian level, and there's every kind of organisms you can describe in the Cambrian level. And, of course, you know, creationists explain the levels, the various, you know, the sedimentary levels that we see around the globe in terms of the global flood. But evolutionists say, well, no, that was a slow and gradual process. And, we got this Cambrian explosion. We got all these organisms forming. It looks like it's formed in a very short period of time. We're in trouble. So we'll come up with a new theory of evolution. We've got the new theory called punctuated evolution. So obviously evolution had to occur because, hey, we're existing and we're here. So evolution had to occur if you're looking for a natural model. And so they just changed the name and said, okay, evolution, there's spurts in evolution. We don't understand why, but there's spurts in evolution, and we can have such things as the Cambrian explosion. And then comes this paper, again, this mathematical paper that says, wait a minute. If you change all of these things very rapidly, there's just, you know, mathematically, there's just not enough time. You don't have enough time to pull out all the blue marbles, you know, that you need in order to make a new species or a new kind. And so even that theory is falling apart, even just from a mathematical point of view, which, you know, these folks are doing. And so now, you know, evolution as we go along here, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. But, you know, people who believe in evolution, it's a belief. you know, it's a belief system. It's not based on scientific fact. It's based on a belief that, hey, because we exist, therefore this must have happened. And so, you know, it's actually worse than believing in a creator, because there's so much evidence that everything is so complex that believing in a creator would say, okay, yeah, I can understand an intelligent creator designing all of this and putting it all together. But for it to just come together by random chance, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Interesting, because all along they've had to exclude evidence of creation in order to make what they call a theory work, but it's not really a theory, is it? It's more like a hypothesis. It's not been advanced by real world evidence.
It hasn't, and even though many people work in the field of, you know, like I said, evolutionary biology, for example, and they're saying, oh, because, you know, the DNA sequence of this is similar to the DNA sequence in this other animal or species, therefore we evolved, doesn't make it so. I mean, you know, of course, you know, the creationists look at that and say, hey, we've got the same designer for all of this stuff, and once you come up with a working machine, for example, a cellular machine, you're going to use that multiple places. It's just like us. I mean, once we discovered that, hey, you know, we can move things around better if we have a wheel, for example, as opposed to, you know, just scooting along the ground or having a sled. You know, maybe we should use wheels in all of our vehicles. And sure enough, we've got wheels and everything, right? And because it works. It works better than a sled, for example, except on snow.
Which case, yeah.
You know, so it really is you have to have a stronger faith in evolution than, let's say, a Christian has in a creator God. Of course, we believe in a creator God, and we believe in he gave us the information that we needed, that we are created, and he gave us the information that, hey, you know, we are created differently than the animals, because with the animals, Jesus just spoke the animals into existence, but with man, it was Jesus, the Father, and the Holy Spirit all working together, because it says, let us make man in our own image, in the image of God, let us make man, male and female. And so, we are created special, which is another thing, you know, that is important about creation, is that we are created, man is created special. We have a special place above the animals, a little lower than the angels right at the moment, but we are created special, and we are created in God's image. And when you take that message out, then we have all kinds of problems, and people begin to wonder, why am I here even on Earth? And if I'm just a blob I'm just here by chance, then maybe I can kill my fellow man, and it doesn't make any difference because we're all in the same boat.
I found it interesting that you just said a couple of minutes ago that there have been no beneficial mutations, that none of them have been beneficial. Is that fair to say, repeat what you said? I mean, none of them?
Well, that was in the experiments of the fruit flies, Drosophila.
Okay.
And but if you look at the mutations in humans, for example, sickle cell anemia, mm-hmm. is that a benefit? Just because the sickling of your blood cells, turning them from a round disc into a needle, Is that beneficial to those that have? One would say, well, it's beneficial if you get malaria because the disease gets killed off by the sickling of the cells. But, you know, so does the host. You know, the person dies from sickle cell anemia. So that's not very beneficial.
So the change is objective, but the analysis is subjective.
Yeah, the analysis is subjective. Our blood cells aren't supposed to go into a needled state. They have to stay round in order to, and flat like a disc, in order to do their function. And that doesn't happen in sickle cells. And then you might use the example of the sheep. Well, you know, sheep farmers, for example, in Ireland, and they had short hedges and short walls to keep the sheep in, and so they breeded a short-legged sheep that couldn't jump over the hedge. And so you say, well, that's beneficial. Well, you know, it's beneficial to the farmer. I don't think it's necessarily beneficial to the sheep, because now they're more susceptible to varmints in the area that can come, and they can't run away as fast, you know. So, and they can't jump over the hedge to get away.
Again, so, they have to drag their tummies around. I mean, that's terrible.
I guess my second thought was, if all of the mutations are not beneficial, what kind of mathematical probability would that be, that all the mutations are not beneficial and not good?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's Darwin himself, when he went on his boat trip, right? He goes to the Galapagos Islands and he sees the finches, and he's drawing the finches and everything, and he says, "Oh, gee, there's finches with big beaks, and there's finches with small beaks." And lo and behold, the finches, with the bigger beaks can survive when there's a drought, because the seeds are hard, and they got to crack the dried up, skins and everything in order to get to the seeds. Whereas the population shifts to the bigger beaks during that time. But when the rains come, the population shifts back to the smaller beaks, and everybody's happy. So how do you explain that? Well, you know, from an evolutionary point of view, you see, they would say, aha, you see, one has evolved into the other based on environmental pressure. But that's not the case at all. There is variation within a kind, and yes, you have natural selection. Of course, the birds with the bigger beaks can survive in a harsher environment compared with the other, the smaller beaked finches. And so the population as a whole then shifts to the bigger beaks when you're there. But the DNA hasn't changed. The DNA is still there. You just have, a mixed population of big beaks and small beaks within the whole population of finches. And one is selected over the other based on its environment. And we see that in bacteria. We see that in all kinds of things. Of course, we have this big discussion going on right now that, oh, gee, we got the coronavirus, and it's now we're getting variants, and the RNA is changing over time, and it is mutating and still infecting people, and the various variants may or may not be protected by the vaccine. That's we'll see as we go along here, but. Things in that small of a category do change, and do change rapidly. And do they change for the better? Well, it's, one of these things. It's basically going to survive and do what it's going to do. Because of the environment that we live in, mutations are going to occur, and whether or not they will be beneficial to the survival of the organism You know, it really depends on what the mutation is and what the organism is and what the environment is. But also it really, you know, depends on their, at least it, you're not going to see a jump from, example, the virus being turned into a bacteria. I mean, that's just not going to happen. The virus is going to remain a virus, even though we might have changes within its RNA. It's still a virus, and the same thing for a bacteria.
Yeah, no dog has ever changed into a cat, or vice versa. That just doesn't happen. Another question here, and we're kind of short on time, but this occurs to me. The point of this article is that within the Cambrian layer, there are such a diversity of life form that there was not time for DNA to change for one life form to evolve into another. That's the tripping point where evolutionists can't explain this variety of life in such a short period of time. The period of time denoted by the thickness of the layer. But I wonder, is, say, the DNA of a mosquito as complex as the DNA of a man? Or could it change much faster into something else because it's simpler DNA? Which is the case? Are all DNA chains, genomes, equally complicated or not?
I think it has to do with life cycles.
Well, yes, it has to do with, you know, obviously a mosquito's life cycles are much, much shorter than man's, but it also has to do with the complexity. Yes, man's DNA, like I said before, has 3 billion base pairs, and we don't need 3 billion base pairs to code for all the proteins within our body, but, you know, there's all kinds of control mechanisms within the DNA to express various proteins as they are needed. And, you know, we haven't even talked about cell differentiation, of course. That's you know, all of that information has to be encoded as well. So there's that aspect, and a mosquito is obviously a lot more, you know, simple, but it still functions the way it functions, and it's going to function the way it functions as long as its DNA is working properly. But it's more susceptible to change because on the whole, you know, on the percentage basis, for example, because it's got less DNA to deal with than a human has, for example.
Okay.
But let's just talk about, you know, the complexity of all of this. One protein, for example, to code for one protein could be as much on an average of 1,000 base pairs. So, you know, to change that much DNA, would require a tremendous amount of time if you're talking in terms of mutations. And it, like I said, it can't be random because it's got to be in a specific order. So we're talking eons and eons of time just to change one protein. Now, you know, as we were talking about before, you've got, you know, sickle cell anemia, and the only change in the red blood cell, in the hemoglobin, was one amino acid. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about completely changing the protein, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and if one amino acid change caused such drastic effects in the hemoglobin molecule, I mean, the other problem you have is how do you go from a functioning protein to a non-functioning protein for a period of time and then to a completely different protein over a period of time and the organism still surviving?
That's the key.
You got multiple problems here in order to think that evolution is even possible.
And the Discovery Institute's article has been published in a peer-reviewed journal, the Journal of Theoretical Biology. And if you'd like to follow up on this, the Breakpoint transcript is linked in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com. You can go there and click on it and read what we've been discussing, including some internal links that you might find helpful. Dr. Don, again, a biochemist, a member of the board of Creation Moments. I want to remind you that they've got quite a website, creationmoments.com, and you'll find quite a collection of scientific information there in printed form and in video form that supports the biblical story of creation. So you might want to pay them a visit. You can link to them from our site at BrokenRoadRadio.com. Again, their website is CreationMoments.com. Don, we've covered a lot of ground and it's gotten kind of technical today, but we learned something. And thanks to you. And we'll look forward to next week, okay?
Okay, very good. Well, I'm glad I was able to help out. Hopefully we didn't confuse the audience too much.
Well, I'm easily confused. But no, the evolutionists have to be kind of walking on eggshells, so to speak. I'm math doesn't lie, you know? Mathematics is pretty convincing stuff. And so if there's a mathematical argument against evolution, they've got to be worried. We'll see you next week.
Okay, sounds good. So long, folks.
See you, Don. Yep, see you.